Have you ever heard of ASMR? It stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. And it's an embodied neurological phenomenon experienced by some folks. It's often described as a sort of brain tingle. The most common triggers are soft whispering voices, certain specific types of light tapping sounds, humming or fluttering. It's usually considered a very pleasant experience indeed. And for those lucky enough to feel this rather unique brain-based sensation, it can elicit feelings of relaxation and deep calmness, or even a pronounced sense of well-being. Even euphoria. ASMR content had a bit of a moment in the late 2010s with all kinds of folks posting stuff on Instagram attempting to create that perfect ASMR sound and feel. And this is when I got kind of fascinated by it. So when I heard this week that an ASMR video had been posted by the White House to its official Instagram account, I had to check it out. And I got to tell you, what I saw and heard horrified me. The ASMR created for this reel begins with the drone of a jet engine that you can see in the back of the frame. It then transitions to the repeating metallic sound of shackles being slowly pulled out of a plastic crate. These long chains with their metal cuffs at the ends jangle together and then clink on the concrete as they are laid out next to a number of sets already in place on the ground. Next, we hear the clicks of handcuffs being secured as a person we only see from behind and from the neck down has a full set of shackles securely fastened behind their back. The final sound we hear is the clanking of leg chains as someone head stooped and restricted in their movement by their cuffs and chains, slowly climbs the flight of steps to board the waiting plane, the shackles at their ankles knocking against the metal of the steps as they move. This video on the official Instagram page for the White House is titled ASMR, Illegal Alien Deportation Flight. Now, obviously, I can't be sure of the motivation behind creating and posting this. But objectification and dehumanization is never a bit of a joke. It's never benign. It always serves a purpose. And it's as old as the hills. There's evidence of dehumanization being part of the human experience for as long as there have been records of human action and behavior. In fact, it seems crucial. Dehumanization is crucial if we are to enslave or dispossess indigenous folks from their land, or colonize or persecute. If we're to discriminate or even criminalize folks based on their skin color or on their gender, based on ethnicity or physical or cognitive ability or even sexuality or class. Objectification and dehumanization are the primary ways we humans other. The way that we other the ones that we intend to abuse or oppress or be violent towards. And remember, violence takes many forms. Generations of scholarship have shown that we humans are actually quite quite reluctant to inflict pain on each other unless we've gone to some effort to no longer consider the target of our action to be like us, to be fully human. When we no longer see another as kin or as a neighbor, we're able to act in all kinds of truly abhorrent ways, fully justified in our actions because that other isn't like us. And so surely they're not deserving of the same dignity and respect that we would show to one of our own. I'm sure you need no reminding that the Nazis referred to Jewish people as subhuman and vermin, and that Hutu extremists who organized the Rwandan genocide called the Tutsi cockroaches and snakes, that the Israeli government has repeatedly used dehumanizing language about the Palestinians, calling them wild beasts, not human, cancerous. And there are many examples of ways that undocumented migrants in this country are consistently being othered in a similar way. Dehumanizing or objectifying rhetoric will embolden those who are ready to internalize the language, or already have internalized the language, believe it, and perhaps act on it. And it will also enrage those who oppose it. So the violence of dehumanization can easily escalate to actually become a source of conflict in itself. And additional violences spilling out in all directions will inevitably result. Dehumanization will always be the source of great suffering for those who are targeted, for those who are enraged, and for all of those unwittingly caught up in the violence of all of it. And this is precisely where I found myself this week. Enraged, filling up with all kinds of thoughts about them, and feeling quite satisfied, actually, about the righteousness of my response. And the loud, repeating dialogue running through my mind was wrestling with what kind of people surely could they be? What kind of malfunctioning minds must they surely have to think this was an appropriate video to post? Surely they have no compassion, no inherent ability to respect or maintain the dignity of a fellow human being despite the circumstances. Words like demonic and heartless, cruel, evil, all floated into my awareness. Not like me, I thought. Not like my people. And then I realized where I was going. I was going down the same well-trodden path in my response. I was doing my bit to keep the cycle going. I felt satisfied in that moment that I was fully justified, and yet I was doing the same thing. I was dehumanizing, and I was making those I disagreed with different from me, less than. And Jesus said, I say to you that listen, love your enemies. But I only know that well-trodden path. I have no clue, actually, what a response rooted in love would really feel like or be like. I'm pretty confident that at least initially it won't be half as satisfying as the response that effortlessly arose in me in that moment. And Jesus said to his disciples, love your enemies. And the great wisdom here that struck me this week is that in my own way, I was doing my bit to keep the great wheel of hate turning. When my response to abuses, to oppression and discrimination also dehumanize, I am not doing a new thing. I am not insisting on healing. I am not insisting there is another way to respond that is born of love. And actually, I'm not entirely sure that there is actually an alternative way already in place, one that I can find and follow if I look hard enough. I actually think that this other way, this new thing Jesus calls his followers to, is something born of the wilderness experience. We talked a little bit about last week, the wilderness experience. Perhaps I can only begin to understand what on earth Jesus meant by love your enemies. Perhaps I can only really truly understand what on earth he meant by that if I set down all I've practiced my whole life, my now very easy repertoire of responses, my very well thought out set of beliefs and opinions about how to counter and how to resist those I deeply and entirely and fundamentally disagree with. I have to set it all down and step into the wilderness of not knowing. Trusting that as a follower of Jesus, my task is to take seriously my faithfulness to him and to God, and that this will lead me in the right direction. And then I felt the biting risk of that. How daunting it is to stand on the edge of an entirely unfamiliar landscape. What if I'm wrong? But Jesus never promised us safety or certainty, but the deep, abiding love of God and freedom and fullness of life. And it's here I hope to find my courage to go out into that wilderness of not knowing any other way and to be transformed by that and to do my bit to break the cycle, to truly learn, understand the meaning of love your enemies.